Hi guys, welcome to episode 6 of the MHP podcast. Today we'll be covering fascial training, how to train around fatigue, and debunking common core training myths. To start off, we'll be going over the basics. What is fascial training, Jacob, and what results does it claim to provide?
Yeah, so the fascial training thing has kind of become like a modern strength conditioning movement where essentially it's preached as like the anecdote to the traditional like powerlifting inspired strength conditioning model. And they essentially try to go to like the opposite extreme. Like strength conditioning today has evolved a lot from it basically kind of looking like powerlifter training. But they basically kind of went into that opposite extreme of what it used to be, where it's a lot of really lightly loaded, kind of like long range of motion, fluid kind of athletic movements, that basically preach to like develop the elasticity and the power that the fascia can create, to essentially create better athleticism. But it does leave at least some boxes unchecked. There's a lot of things I like about it, but I think it's a small part of the training process for me.
Right. And I know you've made a couple posts citing some issues with this training style, and you kind of just touched on it right now. What are they getting wrong? What are some things that they're not really checking off?
Yeah. So if you look at an athletic movement, I actually, when talking about fascia, one of my favorite things to think about is the javelin throw. And I would encourage anyone listening to just go on YouTube and look up javelin throw, because that is one of the most kind of like extreme, elastic, maybe fascial driven movements that you might come across. Is very fun to watch for me. But
yeah, it's amazing. They go so far.
Even something like that, where you would say it's very fascially driven, any kind of athletic movement is going to be driven by the muscular system, which is the only tissue in the body that can actually create force. The fascia and the tendons and all the other stuff are also contributing to the movement, but all they're doing is returning energy that's put into them. So it's all that stuff you think of as like a rubber band, where if you put force into it to stretch it, it'll give you that force back. So it's a very, very important part of athletic movements, because it's essentially free energy, depending on how the things are created. But you can't neglect the muscular system, which is essentially generating movement to begin with, and is going to be your force producer. So my opinion has always been, when I look at what kind of like the fascial training coaches or the purists do, is the muscular system is largely getting ignored, and not ignored, because even fascial training exercises, the muscles are involved, but you're not loading them in a way that optimizes for enhancing force production and things like that. So I think, you know, touching on this kind of like old school powerlifting strength conditioning model, I think modern day strength conditioning, at least the people in the industry that are doing a good job, which is not everybody. But the top tier range of this industry, you're doing a lot of things that address the elastic components of the movements, and alongside enhancing force production, things like that. And I think those things done in the right kind of combination, that is your gold standard for development. And leaving either side of the equation unchecked is a bad move.
Yeah, then you're missing things.
Exactly. So I think one of the easiest ways to think about this, this could be something listeners could look up online, is the force velocity curve. So essentially, high force activities have a low velocity, like think of this as like your heavy back squat. It's not going to move very fast because you're overcoming a lot of force. And then something like a very, very light medicine ball throw is going to have a lot of velocity. And it's on the lower end of the force spectrum and
weighs less.
Exactly. So you want to, one of the expressions that got drilled into me early on was surf the curve.
Yeah.
Meaning throughout your training, you want to visit various points along that line. Not just high force, low velocity and high velocity, low force, but also the various combinations in between.
Yeah.
And that's, again, like that's another way you can think of it. If you are getting that done, if you're visiting those various points along the curve, then you're going to be doing very well for yourself in your training and probably developing a little better than the fascial purists out there.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about this, what are some examples of movements and exercises that we can actually use to train our fascia?
Yeah, so the quickest examples I usually turn to are medicine ball throws, because the best utilization of the fascial system is usually something where the upper and the lower body are kind of integrated and rotating opposite to each other. Like when the left leg is pulled back and the right arm is pulled back and the distance between the right hand and the left foot gets really, really exaggerated. You have to imagine like, probably the easiest way to think of it, if you just think of the fascia, like the same as the skin, it's like, what would I have to do to stretch the skin across the front side of my body? I would reach my left foot back and my right arm back. And that kind of, and that is all
opens
integrated.
Everything up.
Well, yeah. And it's all integrated. So that's that storing of the elastic force that you then put into, like a baseball throw or like, and that's where the medicine ball throws come in, because you can use different stances and different steps and different kind
single
of
leg, full
yeah,
base.
And different dynamic movements to build up. So a lot of different med ball throws in different planes, rotational, overhead. That's probably
you're a big fan of med ball throws.
I am.
In general.
I think it gets underused because athletes will do a lot of,
I agree.
Jumps and sprints and like that's a huge part of the program, but the the upper body component of elasticity, athleticism, explosiveness, that gets underutilized sometimes. And again, like we're going to talk a little bit later about core, having something where you are rotating around your midsection, moving a load with the upper body that requires the lower body to be firmly grounded and things like that, keeps things integrated a lot more. And another exercise, actually, so today, a little practical example from recent history, I was training some volleyball players today, and we did an exercise where we had a BOSU ball on the ground, and they you're sitting in front of the BOSU ball, and you kind of arch your back over around the ball, and then you come off of it kind of like an explosive sit-up into an overhead medicine ball throw.
Right, so you're holding it.
You're holding it behind your head. You kind of lengthen, stretch everything, and then sit up explosively and launch it. And if you think about what's happening, you're getting the front part of the core lengthened and engaged. You're getting like the chest and the shoulders and everything along the front side of the chain gets lengthened into a really explosive throw. And
that's very relatable to the sport of volleyball too, because that's what happens when you're hitting.
100%. And I think it's very irresponsible to think about, say, shoulder power in absence of considering the core, because like in volleyball, for example, you're never, ever, ever going to hit a ball without the front part of your abs being involved and engaged and having
it's
to
impossible.
Do some work. So that was just an example from today where I tried to integrate things a little bit.
Awesome. Well, there you go. Now we're going to go into topic number two. Recently, we've been discussing sleep and, you know, how it has a really big role in performance and also an athlete's readiness to train. How would you modify a workout to account for various levels of fatigue?
Yeah, so the simplest way to think of it is almost thinking of the force velocity curve in a way. The highest speed actions, like sprints and jumps and medicine ball throws, those are very taxing to the nervous system. And
yes,
oftentimes that feeling of fatigue that we get, sometimes it's mechanical, like my muscles are sore. But I think oftentimes, especially when it relates to stress and sleep, and just overall weekly training load, it's a CNS nervous system fatigue that kind of brings the whole system down. And being that those high speed activities are very neurologically intensive, that would be the first thing to go or to reduce the load of. So if you just subjectively felt like you weren't in the best state on a given day, you just felt tired and slow and sluggish, potentially if you look at your workout plan, and hopefully things are structured where you have some speed stuff, some strength stuff, you know, you have a mix of all the training qualities, it would be the speed and power work that you'd either want to reduce or take out for that day, worst case scenario. If you were in a really bad state, then your heavy, heavy lifting would be the next thing to go, because that's another very neurologically taxing. Yes. After that, the things that usually you can almost always train is like your lower intensity, higher volume training. So usually things that fall into that category is like some core exercises, some isolated muscle groups, which in an athletic setting, usually you're looking at individual weak points. So like if you've had like a Achilles tear in your past or something like that, then maybe you're doing higher volume stuff for the calf and the Achilles, things like that. So something that you usually don't have to cut from the program is like, you know, calf raises and core exercises and things that are a little more isolated, usually you're doing for higher reps, which might sound counterintuitive, but the higher rep stuff is actually going to be easier to do in those fatigue states than kind of like the low rep, high force work.
That's interesting,
And then the last thing that I think always just you can keep it rock solid in there all the time is the aerobic work. And so this means the intensity is very low. It's kind of like when you're just breaking a very light sweat and holding for a long duration.
Right.
That's something even on your worst day, you could probably benefit from doing some of that. So that could be like a framework for you to take home to, you know, if you have all these factors in your program, kind of depending on how fatigued you feel, you just kind of trim from the top.
Instead of just doing nothing.
Exactly. So making sure you're still getting some reps in for sure.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I'm curious, is it possible to improve this fatigue state without an additional day's rest? Or is that the only solution?
Yeah, so back one of my first coaching jobs, I was at King's Christian working with, shout out Jeff Aldom. He's been a very good mentor for me from day one. And he brought this tech in called Omega Wave, which basically uses a heart rate strap and electrode sensors to measure, to kind of give you a readiness measurement or like the status of your nervous system at that time.
Right.
And it, essentially if you have like a Fitbit or an Oura Ring or a watch that kind of gives you like a readiness score for the day, that's essentially trying to estimate what this thing was actually measuring.
That's so cool.
So it was a very cool device, and it would actually give you recommendations, similar to what we just covered, where if you were at a certain fatigue state, it would actually say like, hey, we don't recommend you do speed and power stuff today.
Was this tool something that you measured at the beginning when the athletes were coming in, or was it something that the athletes kept on throughout their workout?
So it actually required you to be like laying down, quiet, lights off.
Wow, that's so
So
cool.
not something you can measure during, but something we did when they came in, and then usually at the
Right.
end as well.
Just to see like how taxing that workout is on you,
That too,
right?
yeah.
That's
So
cool.
something that we found, because there was multiple times where an athlete came in and things were tanked, because when you're in high school and you've got, exam stresses and you're practicing every day, and it's common that life kind of wears you down a little bit.
It happens.
There'd be multiple times where an athlete would come in and the Omega Wave device would basically say, can't train anything, just the aerobic. That's the only thing that's advisable
Wow.
to touch today. So what we would do is we'd say, okay, get on the bike, do like 20, 30 minutes at a low intensity. And then we'd retest them. And on the retest, the fatigue score actually improved,
Yeah.
where
Exercise helps.
after the time on the bike, it was now saying, hey, you can go do some heavy strength training.
That is so cool.
So then after that, we'd be like, okay, like let's get some lifting in. And then
There
they
you
would
go.
go and actually do more than what they showed up ready to do. So if you follow that hierarchy and you're just tanked one day, you go do your aerobic work, and then I would say just see how you're feeling after that. Potentially, I think there was maybe one time where someone's score didn't improve, but there was
They're
many
probably
occasions.
exhausted.
But there was many occasions where it was just the norm, where you would see the score go up after that work. So I would keep that in the program, make sure you get that in, and then just check in with yourself after, and maybe there's room. Maybe if you're like, okay, I'm already here and I feel ready to go get some more stuff in.
And this is kind of a question out of curiosity, because I know that sometimes people talk about whether it's better to train aerobically before or after a lift. Did you find that that affected actually how heavy they could lift? Or is that just getting into the more specific like glycogen storages that are being used or PCR and stuff like that?
Yeah, in general, perfect world scenario, all the conditioning happens at the end. But if you think of it, one, in this way, you're looking at this like the conditioning is going to be the only thing you're able to do anyways. So you're just starting with it. And the second thing is you're so fatigued on that day anyways, you're probably not going and hitting PRs on any lifts.
No.
So even if the aerobic work maybe like fatigue the muscles a little bit, I would argue that the priming of the nervous system that you got from it probably outweighs that. And again, it's like whatever reps you got that day were kind of borrowed free reps that you weren't going to get otherwise. So even if you get like an 80% kind of efficiency of a workout over 100, it's like
It's still better than nothing.
it's a
Yeah, I
bonus.
totally agree. Awesome. Now getting into topic three, this is a pretty big one. We're gonna be covering common core training myths. So can we just start off by actually explaining what core strength is and why it's actually important to have? Because I think people kind of get lost between like abs and core and the importance of it.
Yeah, so I always like to think about, I like to imagine the rib cage and the shoulders, or like say the throw their arms in there, and then you have the pelvis where your hips are and the lower half. And in between, yeah, there's a spine that runs up and down, but that spine's not doing anything for you. In between, the integrity of the core muscles determines how well these two halves work together, how much force you can transfer up and down, and
Injury prevention.
100%. And it gets into the fascial stuff too, because you have these big fascial lines that run across the midline of the body. And
Transfers too.
yeah, so it's it's extremely important in essentially like all athletic movements. There's almost nothing you can do athletically that doesn't demand something of the core. Because even something very lower body, like a jump, you have to be able to direct your upper body as well. And if you imagine trying to jump with like a wet noodle for an upper body, that would just flop over to the side. Wow. Or, you know, like even strictly lower body things, you need an organized midsection to kind of direct your mass in the direction it needs to go. So I would say it's very undervalued and kind of underrated in how it influences all the athletic things we do.
Yeah. And, you know, relating this to the quick shred app programs, what are the issues with these type of programs and just practically following these type of programs that are kind of inspired by the bodybuilding aspect and on the aesthetics world?
Yeah. That's a large issue because I think people tend to fall into the trap of thinking of the abs or the core as different than any other muscle. Yep. And at the end of the day, it's all contractile muscle tissue. If usually these programs are very, very high volume, which means it's biasing towards hypertrophy and size, not necessarily for strength, force production, all these other things that are actually relevant to the athletic things that we want to be doing. So, you know, like doing endless crunches or planks for however long, like it's dangerous to take these things from the bodybuilding world. Same way, you know, if you took a leg training program from a bodybuilder, but you had goals to jump high and run fast and things like that, like,
yeah, you're training for the wrong thing.
You'll develop aesthetically good looking legs that don't perform the way you want them to.
Yeah, exactly.
So, in general, with the core, like you want to be training strength and some velocity and things like that. So, yeah, would not advise those shred programs or anything like that.
They were trending badly. But relating it to the kind of simple frameworks, do you have any that athletes listening could actually apply to ensure that their core training will be effective?
Yeah. So the way I think about core training, I think is relatively simple once you kind of can visualize it. Mm-hmm. You take the three different categories. You have linear, which is anything front to back. So the simplest example that's not moving, but would be like a plank, where it's the front side of the core doing the work, stabilizing. A dynamic example could be like a hanging knee raise, bringing your knees towards your chest, something where the front side is dominating the movement. Then you have the lateral component of the core. So think side plank, or like a single arm suitcase carry or something where essentially
one side.
Yeah, essentially the forces are trying to bend your torso sideways and you're having to resist laterally. And then most importantly is the rotational as the third category. So a static example of that could be like a Palloff press where you're resisting the rotation. And then something that's very similar but active is like a chop, taking a cable and actually rotating through it. Those would be your three categories. And then if you have exercises from each that are both static, like not moving, and dynamic, where you're moving through the motion, you're going to be covering most of your bases. And then I think it's bonus points if you can start adding in like things that integrate the core a little more, like a rotational med ball throw, where it's not necessarily, most people wouldn't look at it and think it's a core exercise, but a lot of the force that's being generated from something like that is coming from the coiling and uncoiling of your midsection. So, you know, just in the essence of trying to be athletic, like develop the strength and the like tissue capabilities, and then apply athletic things on top, rotate explosively,
and actually practicing them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, during COVID, I'm sure, you know, one of the biggest trends were abs in 2 weeks. And it actually convinced thousands of people to do them, including me, if I'm being honest. What is the problem with these type of workouts? Are they a myth or do they actually work?
Well, I think, first of all, the being able to see abs has no correlation or indication of like the function of your core. So that's
right. That's the biggest thing.
That would be the first and foremost thing to bring up. But the other thing is like there's a lot of factors. Like one, body fat percentage is also going to be the biggest factor. But then also, if you're trying to strengthen your core anyways, as long as you're making progress, you know, it's like if there was a program that would be like, you can be a 300-pound bodybuilder in 2 weeks. And it's like, okay, that's realistic.
What are the odds of that?
Well, that's realistic for the 299-pound bodybuilder, but not for the 160-pound. So it kind of like,
exactly.
You know, take where you're starting from and where you're trying to go. Then just
totally.
make progress over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, these type of workouts, they made a lot of damage because even I remember, like, it was, I think there was one of the creators that made these trends was Chloe Ting or something like that.
Okay.
I completely forget the name. And you know, there were people in the comments after 2 weeks commenting like, some people would actually say that they, you know, noticed results. And as you said, I would assume that that is because they actually were closer to achieving that goal. But then there were other people that were like, you know what, screw this. This is not working. But it was, yeah, one of the biggest trends definitely during COVID. So I'm glad that we covered that.
Well, and that's the thing when you get like a cookie cutter program is
yes,
even the most generic, like basic thing that you throw out there will work for some percentage of people.
Right.
And then the creator of these things takes that, I don't know, whatever percent, say it's 5%, takes all the good things that they're saying and is like, here's why it's going to work for you, and bang, bang, bang.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to work for certain people that actually fit into the cookie cutter, but the rest of the 90% of the population is, yeah, it's not going to work. So that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I think that ends today's episode. Thank you guys for joining and listening in, and make sure to tune in for the next episode. See you guys.
Absolutely. Thank you. See ya.